This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, prospects for the Ukrainian ceasefire. Reaction to rival Yemeni parties reportedly agreeing on a transitional council. Islamic State and other militant threats raises costs for aid workers. And we continue our lesson on internet hygiene.
You really should not use those free Wi-Fis, because as you can get in equally free, so can everyone else.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The foreign ministers of France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine are trying to salvage a multinational ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, reached earlier this month in Belarus. While the truce appears to be holding in some places, the United States Monday expressed alarm over violations around the town of Debaltseve, which fell February 15th to pro-Russian separatists with Russian support, and the port city of Mariupol, which remains in Ukrainian hands. The separatists are reportedly massing forces near Mariupol and continuing to attack government positions. University of Melbourne European analyst Leslie Templeman-Holmes tells VOA's Victor Beattie the ceasefire is not dead, but its future is in doubt.
The rebels seem to have a fixed idea as to how much territory they want to take. And whatever President Putin says in Russia about support for this most recent agreement, the fact is that Russia isn't doing too much to stop those rebels expanding their influence.
What do you think their ultimate goal may be?
I suspect that there are actually divisions amongst the rebels themselves. Some would be content with devolved power. Others would actually like to set up a separate East Ukrainian state. I think the former is much more likely in the long term. And under the recent Minsk agreement, there is provision for a devolution by the end of this year that would give eastern Ukraine a lot more autonomy than it currently has.
How severe a defeat was the loss by Ukraine of Debaltseve?
It was strategically very important and symbolically very important. It means that the rebels now have a continuous tract of land between Luhansk and Donetsk and a major transport hub. I mean, from Kiev's perspective, that in itself was a loss, but it's also a symbolic loss because it means that the rebels are able to continue whatever the Minsk agreements, there's been two major agreements now, whatever the Minsk agreements claim is going to be happening, the rebels are just going their own way and are determined to take as much East Ukrainian territory as possible.
Does Ukraine appear to have a very weak hand if negotiations resume?
It does if it's reliant only on its own forces. This is where the West comes into play. At the moment, the West still doesn't want to get involved in a direct military sense, but the sanctions are definitely affecting Russia. Its economy is really suffering now, and President Obama and Western leaders are talking about further sanctions. There's going to come a point where Putin's nationalism and his expansionism is going to confront the fact that his economy is in serious problems.
The foreign ministers of France, Germany, Russia, and Ukraine are to meet in Paris to try to get the peace agreement back on track. What are the prospects for success?
Unfortunately, the past precedent doesn't augur particularly well. And I think one very important point is that it's all very well to have summits, but you actually need the rebel leaders involved because they're the ones that are calling the tune and have been for the last year or so.
What are the prospects for some sort of negotiated agreement?
We've now got more than 5,500 people killed. We've got more than a million people displaced. There comes a point at which pride has to be swallowed. And much as I, like most outside observers, would not really want to see this, I think we just have to be realists about this. And there is going to come a point where Kiev is going to have to negotiate and certainly allow rather more autonomy than is currently on the board.
Holmes says events are not being driven by Russia, but Russian President Vladimir Putin, who likens himself to Tsar Nicholas I, whose 30-year reign in the 19th century was marked by geographical expansion. He says the best way to check Mr. Putin's adventurism is sanctions. He says they're working, but to weaken the Russian economy sufficiently, they'll take time. Yemen's ousted President Abed Rabah Mansour Hadi has rejected the Shiite rebel takeover of his country's capital and the government. In a statement, Mr. Hadi declared all steps taken by the Houthis illegitimate and called on them to release top officials in his government from house arrest. United Nations envoy to Yemen, Jamal Ben Umar, says rival Yemeni parties have agreed on a transitional council to help guide the country through its political crisis. Under the plan, Yemen's 301-member lower house of parliament will remain in place, The legislature is made up overwhelmingly of MPs loyal to the Shiite Muslim group known as the Houthis, who effectively took power in Sana'a after forcing President Abed Rabo Mansour Hadi to resign last month. The upper house of parliament will be replaced by the Transitional Council, whose members were not immediately identified. The UN envoy called the move an important step, but noted that a number of issues still need to be resolved within a specific timeline. Mohammed Al-Basha, spokesman for the Yemeni embassy in Washington, spoke about the developments with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
I think the correct term to describe his announcement is that the political parties, after a long night of negotiations and direct talks, reached a consensus on keeping the current House of Representatives and adding a new transitional parliament. Both chambers will form the new so-called National Congress. The House of Representatives is 301 members. The new transitional parliament will be 251 members, so the total number of members for the National Congress will be around 551. This is a welcoming step. It's a positive step after 20-plus days of talks that they were able to reach a consensus, but there's still other major topics that have to be discussed.
How would that Congress satisfy the other political groups who were looking for bigger share in the parliament?
I think the traditional powers, the former ruling party and Islah and JMP are satisfied that the House of Representatives was not dissolved. The so-called constitutional declaration, that the one-sided declaration by the Houthis to dissolve the parliament in one of their clauses, obviously at this point, is not effective because the parliament will continue, but they're just going to add another house. They're going to add another transitional parliament. The transitional parliament will include all the players that were not involved in the House of Representatives. So this will give a legislative platform for other factions and parties to be involved in. The distribution will be 50% of the transitional parliament will be given to members from the northern governorates and 50% to the southern provinces. 30% will be given quota to women and 20% to youth representatives.
UN mediator Jamal Ben Omar said there remain a number of issues on the dialogue table that need to be completed, dealing with the presidency and with getting political and security agreements for implementation of this deal within a specific timeline. How crucial are these issues to achieve a political solution to the Yemeni crisis?
Yes, this is why it's best to describe the situation as it remains fluid. Yes, there was some sort of light at the end of the tunnel after yesterday's consensus. But the topics ahead that they have to discuss is the Presidential Council. Will it be 5 members, 7 or 9 members? Which of the parties are going to be involved in it? The cabinet, I think the Houthis and Ansarullah has publicly expressed that they wish that the resigned Prime Minister Bahah continues his post or forms a new cabinet, or perhaps there's another candidate. And there's other issues such as re-establishing the elections committee, the national authority to implement the dialogue, and the timeline. The timeline is very crucial. But I think the difficult part in the upcoming negotiations will be the clauses for implementation and the guarantees. What are the guarantees that Ansarullah and other dominant force in the political scene at this point are willing to provide to the other political parties and factions to form this consensus governing body? So it's too early to say what's going to happen. Again, the situation is fluid, but it's a positive sign that for the past 20 days that all the political parties were engaged in daily talks and meetings, and that shows a clear sign that people are working and doing their best to avoid an armed protected conflict.
Would that consensus mean a first step to a national reconciliation, and that Yemen has already avoided a potential civil war?
We hope so. We hope that this is the first step in reconciliation. Ultimately, I think a lot of the problems that emanated from this current political crisis stems from the lack of trust and mistrust between the factions, and reconciliation will be a vital component for us to have sustainable peace. And we hope that this is the correct step in the right path.
Mohammed Al-Basha, spokesman for the Yemeni embassy in Washington. Faced with increased threats of kidnap and death from Islamic State militants, Syria has become a no-go zone for expatriate aid workers, despite the desperation of civilians there. Sharon Bain reports on the ever higher cost of trying to help those in need and the populations left behind.
Aid workers in war zones such as Syria face a relentless cycle of violence and personal risk, says the co-founder of International NGO Safety and Security Association, Amari Cooper.
It's kidnapping, it's direct targeting, bombing, it's threats that are collateral threats that could be sort of just wrong place at the wrong time, where an IED, it happens down the road where there's an IED that goes off. And then they could be direct sort of being used as political pawns, where they're being kidnapped to make a message or kidnapped for ransom.
10 years ago, aid and humanitarian workers largely were seen as separate from the conflicts in which they were trying to operate. Even now, in some conflict countries, aid workers are able to negotiate their presence. But Vice President Joel Charney of Interaction, an alliance of U.S.-based relief and development agencies, says in areas controlled by extremist groups like Islamic State, things have changed.
I think in those particular places, the NGO label or the humanitarian label carries with it, you know, very little protection. And indeed, our community can be seen as a soft target.
American aid worker Kayla Mueller died in 2015 while being held hostage in Syria by Islamic State militants. Just months before, the same group beheaded British aid worker David Haynes, also kidnapped in Syria. According to Humanitarian Outcomes, violent acts against aid workers around the world have increased in the past decade, with kidnapping seeing the steepest rise. In 2012, Afghanistan, Pakistan, South Sudan, and Somalia ranked as the most violent. The vice president of risk management company Unity Resources Group, Jim LeBlanc, says as a result, most aid organizations are reevaluating their security plans.
A lot of these organizations have become much more sophisticated in how they do their duty of care obligations, which is what reasonable steps are they obligated to mitigate the risk of something bad happening to one of their staff. And that duty of care obligation doesn't just pertain to, for example, expats or internationals, but it also goes to how do you take reasonable steps to protect your local staff.
When danger levels are considered too severe, expatriate staff are often evacuated, leaving local staff to continue the aid work. Charney says that not only raises a number of ethical questions, it also has led to increased demands by local staff for compensation, trauma counseling, and so on. Cooper of the International NGO Safety and Security Association says donors and aid organizations have to invest more in security planning, and aid workers need to make sure those plans are in place.
Aid workers, when they are looking for jobs and applying for jobs, should ask, hey, what security measures are in place for us? What is being done? Do you have a crisis management plan? Do you have a way med evacuation or security evacuation plans in place?
Cooper says if an aid organization cannot honestly say that no matter what happens, they can continue operating, then they should not go in. And those who stand to lose the most are the civilian populations left behind, caught in the crossfire with no one to turn to. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter says the United States has the right ingredients in its anti-Islamic State strategy, saying the IS group is hardly invincible. Mr. Carter made the statement after holding hours-long discussions with U.S. military and diplomatic personnel in Kuwait Monday. But he underscored the seriousness and complexity of the IS threat, promising the latest defeat of what he called this brutal group. The defense chief chaired the meeting at the U.S. Army base of Camp Arifjan.
to talk to our political and military, our people who have the most experience in this region and can help me think things through several steps ahead.
Mr. Carter says the U.S.-led air campaign against IS is going well and that the U.S. military is well-suited to carry out a longer-term effort to train and equip opposition rebel forces in Syria. At least two major shopping malls, one in the United States and the other in Canada, are operating with higher security measures following a terrorist threat made by Somali-based Islamist militants. The Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab group released a video over the weekend appearing to call for attacks on Western shopping malls. U.S. State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki called the Al-Shabaab video propaganda and said U.S. intelligence agencies do not have any information to corroborate that any individuals are trying to carry out the Al-Shabaab threat.
Our view is it's propaganda. Of course, we need to remain vigilant, as always is the case. But the point of this video was to instill fear.
Psaki also says the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Department of Homeland Security have increased their collaboration with mall owners over the past months to prevent such attacks.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
North Korea's decision to ban foreigners from participating in the upcoming Pyongyang Marathon is the latest example of how its restrictive response to the threat of Ebola is stifling tourism and other business interests. VOA's Brian Patton reports from Seoul, Pyongyang's sweeping travel restrictions are motivated by both public health and political concerns.
Even though there have been no reported cases of Ebola in Asia, North Korea closed its borders to foreign tourists last October to prevent the spread of the disease. It also imposed a strict 21-day quarantine for foreign aid workers and diplomats who enter the country. Travel agencies now say that authorities are banning foreigners from participating in the upcoming Pyongyang Marathon, one of its most popular tourist events. Last year was the first time foreign runners were allowed to participate. Tour groups were planning to market the event in conjunction with arts festivals and cultural events surrounding the birthday of North Korea's founder, Kim Il-sung, on April 15th. But it is not just tourism that is being affected. Andre Abrahamian, the director of Chosun Exchange, an organization that provides entrepreneurship and economic training to North Koreans, has lost thousands of dollars in grants and contracts because of the travel restrictions.
And they said to us, if you can't guarantee this program will run by the end of March, we need to use it elsewhere. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to make that guarantee. So we have lost some funding.
Abrahamian says under Kim Jong-un, the government has tried to encourage new business and investment ventures despite already strict controls and limited access to the internet and other telecommunications. But the new travel restrictions are setting back these efforts.
So the Ebola thing kind of illustrates the tension between some competing goals at the higher levels of decision making, I think, yeah.
This is not the first time Pyongyang has tightened border controls to avoid disease outbreaks. North Korea closed its borders during the SARS epidemic in 2003, but that disease was prevalent in Asia, especially next door in China. An Chan-il, a North Korean defector and president of the World Institute for North Korean Studies, says Pyongyang's actions this time are in part an overreaction to a real health risk. He says North Korean officials fear North Korea lacks resistance and measures to control Ebola when the disease flows into the country. But he thinks the authoritarian regime is also exaggerating the Ebola threat for political advantage. He says North Korea is warning about the scary infectious disease Ebola, and it is utilizing the disease to create an atmosphere for the Kim Jong-un regime to be established with stability. North Korean media have suggested Ebola was created by the U.S. military as a biological weapon. The Kim Jong-un regime has been growing increasingly isolated due to the ongoing pressure from the UN over his human rights record and increased sanctions from Washington over its alleged involvement in the massive cyber attack on Sony Pictures in December. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
Monday on International Edition, we were hearing from VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard on his tips for internet hygiene. He suggested so far hardening your passwords, changing that password now and then, and watching out for what you click on. Today we asked about using public Wi-Fi.
All of those portable devices that we have, they are so hungry for connection to the internet. So when we're out and about in the streets, at a cafe, at a restaurant, shopping, many places now are offering free Wi-Fi. And it's very tempting to go on those free Wi-Fi networks, especially if there's no password. They just say, hey, everybody, just come on in. You really should not use those free Wi-Fis because as you can get in equally free, so can everyone else. And once you're in, I've seen people do this. It's astoundingly easy for, say, me, if we were in the same shop, for me to peek into your device, maybe seize control of your device, maybe download all of the data on your phone, all your contacts, all your emails, that kind of thing. So unless you absolutely have to use free Wi-Fi, don't.
Well, let me ask you this, Doug. What about if you're at home and you have one of those non-wire internet things? Can your neighbors peep into what you're up to?
It all depends. Many people have these systems now, but they're password protected. So let's say you're at home and you open up, say, your iPad, and it goes sniffing for networks, and maybe it finds 10. 9 of them are your neighbors, and 1 of them is yours. You'll very often see a little padlock next to where it's telling you, you know, such a network A, for example. If there's a little padlock, that means it at the least is password protected so that only people with that password can get in. And if it's your neighbor's house, it's very likely only your neighbors have that password. So that's relatively secure. But if you see an open network when you're going sniffing out networks to join on, no padlock, even if it's your neighbor's, by all means, do not use that. And I would even suggest to them, you should think about locking that account.
And anything else that we should be thinking about?
Yes. And this is probably the trickiest one, which is don't assume anything online. It's very natural for us when we get an email from a friend we like or we visit a web page that we've been to a lot before to just assume that what we're seeing is what we believe it to be. But hackers are becoming very sophisticated in terms of how they, for example, might manipulate your contacts list to send you emails from somebody listed as a friend so that they can, again, break into your system, maybe put a virus on your computer, install some malware on your phone, setting up what they call man-in-the-middle attacks. These are phony websites that you go to. You believe you're going to, say, Amazon.com, and they set up a phony website. It's not Amazon.com. There's something just a little bit off in there, and they're sitting there just waiting and collecting all of your data and, again, infecting your systems. So, again, we can't be paranoid, but it's worth taking a moment to look at the website. If something looks off about the website that you're at, just give it an extra look. Check that address bar, the URL bar. Or if you get a note from a friend, say, and perhaps it just seems off, like I haven't heard from them for a while, or this seems to be kind of, this isn't how they talk. Again, I would contact that person through different means, maybe through Facebook or through another email account, or just pick up the phone and call them and ask, is this really you? Did you really send this?
Well, thank you very much, Doug, for stopping by.
Absolutely, anytime.
VOA cyber correspondent Doug Bernard. See his fuller list of internet hygiene habits in his column, 11 Ways to Keep Yourself Safe Online, at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day at our website. I just mentioned it, voanews.com. You can also listen to this program again or yesterday's program or any of our international edition of recent months. Just go to the website and go to the programs tab and scroll down to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.